When the emergency room staff saw the brain scans of the 86-year-old man with a subdural hematoma, they immediately paged the neurosurgeon on duty. He was in the middle of a routine spinal surgery, but when he got the page, he stepped away from the operating table and looked at images of the elderly man's head on a computer screen. The surgeon told his assistant, a nurse practitioner, to go to the emergency room and get the man's wife to sign a consent form approving surgery. He finished his spinal procedure. A half hour later, the elderly man was wheeled into the same operating theater. Nurses were rushing around. The unconscious elderly man was placed on the table. A nurse picked up his consent form and medical chart. "Doctor," the nurse said, looking at the patient's chart, "the consent form doesn't say where the hematoma is." The nurse leafed through the paperwork. There was no clear indication of which side of his head they were supposed to operate on. Every hospital relies upon paperwork to guide surgeries. Before any cut is made, a patient or family member is supposed to sign a document approving each procedure and verifying the details. In a chaotic environment, where as many as a dozen doctors and nurses may handle a patient between the ER and the recovery suite, consent forms are the instructions that keep track of what is supposed to occur. Except in emergencies, no one is supposed to go into surgery without a signed and detailed consent. "I saw the scans before," the surgeon said. "It was the right side of the head. If we don't do this quickly, he's going to die." "Maybe we should pull up the films again," the nurse said, moving toward a computer terminal. For security reasons, the hospital's computers locked after 15 minutes of idling. It would take at least a minute for the nurse to log in and load the patient's brain scans onto the screen. "We don't have time," the surgeon said. "They told me he's crashing. We've got to relieve the pressure." "What if we find the family?" the nurse asked. "If that's what you want, then call the fucking ER and find the family. In the meantime, I'm going to save his life." The surgeon grabbed the paperwork, scribbled "right" on the consent form, and initialed it. "There," he said. "We have to operate immediately." The nurse had worked at Rhode Island Hospital for a year. He understood the hospital's culture. This surgeon's name, the nurse knew, was often scribbled in black on the large whiteboard in the hallway, signaling that nurses should beware. The unwritten rules in this scenario were clear. The surgeon always wins. The nurse put down the chart and stood aside as the doctor positioned the elderly man's head in a cradle that provided access to the right side of his skull and shaved and applied antiseptic to his head. The plan was to open the skull and suction out the blood pooling on top of his brain. The surgeon sliced away a flap of scalp, exposed the skull, and put a drill against the white bone. He began pushing until the bit broke through with a soft pop. He made two more holes and used a saw to cut out a triangular piece of the man's skull. Underneath was the dura, the translucent sheath surrounding the brain. "Oh my God," someone said. There was no hematoma. They were operating on the wrong side of the head. "We need him turned," the surgeon yelled. The triangle of bone was reattached with small metal plates and screws, and the patient's scalp sewed up. His head was shifted to the other side, and then, once again, shaved, cleansed, cut, and drilled, until a triangle of skull could be removed. This time, the hematoma was immediately visible, a dark bulge that spilled like thick syrup when the dura was pierced. The surgeon vacuumed the blood, and the pressure inside the old man's skull fell immediately. The surgery, which should have taken about an hour, had run almost twice as long. Afterward, the patient was taken to the intensive care unit, but he never regained full consciousness. 2 weeks later, he died. A subsequent investigation said it was impossible to determine the precise cause of death. But the patient's family argued that the trauma of the medical error had overwhelmed his already fragile body, that the stress of removing two pieces of skull, the additional time in surgery, and the delay in evacuating the hematoma had pushed him over the edge. If not for the mistake, they claimed, he might still be alive. The hospital paid a settlement, and the surgeon was barred from ever working at Rhode Island Hospital again. Such an accident, some nurses later claimed, was inevitable. Rhode Island Hospital's institutional habits were so dysfunctional, it was only a matter of time until a grievous mistake occurred. It's not just hospitals that breed dangerous patterns, of course. Destructive organizational habits can be found within hundreds of industries and at thousands of firms. And almost always, they are the products of thoughtlessness, of leaders who avoid thinking about the culture and so let it develop without guidance. There are no organizations without institutional habits. There are only places where they are deliberately designed and places where they are created without forethought. So they often grow from rivalries or fear. But sometimes, even destructive habits can be transformed by leaders who know how to seize the right opportunities. Sometimes, in the heat of a crisis, the right habits emerge.